Hello and welcome to How to Fail with Elizabeth Day, the podcast that celebrates the things that haven't gone right. This is a podcast about learning from our mistakes and understanding that why we fail ultimately makes us stronger. Because learning how to fail in life actually means learning how to succeed better. I'm your host, author and journalist Elizabeth Day, and every week I'll be asking a new interviewee what they've learned from failure. Candice Carty-Williams was working full-time as a publishing marketing executive when she wrote her first novel. It told the story of the life and loves of a 25-year-old Jamaican-British woman called Queenie. It became a publishing sensation. Queenie won the 2019 Book of the Year at the British Book Awards, making Carty-Williams the first Black author to do so. Now, her second novel, People Person, is about to be published. A TV adaptation of Queenie for Channel 4 is in the works, and she's writing an original drama for the BBC. But being a full-time writer was never her career plan. Growing up in South London, Carty-Williams has said she didn't believe author was an attainable goal. That changed when she was excluded from school for a week in her teens. Her stepfather sent her to the library every day, and reading became her refuge. She devoured Catherine Cookson, Virginia Andrews, and Mallory Blackman. When later Carty-Williams started working in publishing, she was struck by how few fictional characters represented her reality. So she wrote Queenie. Critics have hailed it as both a smart and breezy comic debut and astutely political, an essential commentary on everyday racism. As for Carty-Williams herself, she says she simply wanted to write a female protagonist who seemed real. So many women, characters and in real life, are meant to be nice, she has said. Why is that? I'm not interested in being nice. What a boring descriptor. Candice Carty-Williams, you are so welcome on How to Fail. Thank you for being unnice.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
I so agree with you. When I came across that quote in an interview you gave, I was sort of fist pumping in the air because I find it so annoying when readers sometimes take predominantly female authors to task for writing quote unquote unlikable characters. Because I don't know about you, but I feel like there's no such thing as an unlikable character.
There's not. And I just think that as a reader, I've never been interested in that either. The characters that I love to hate are the ones who are, you know, they're the ones who engage me, you know? So I was like, none of this nice business.
And do you think there's a sense that that's how we expect women to be? We expect them to be nice and pliable and likable. And were you trying to challenge that with Queenie?
All the time. I think that women in fiction, women on television, women in real life are expected to be nice and to be the caregivers. And I find that really boring. And it's just not what I subscribe to. And it's not what I'm interested in my life and also what I engage in. So I think I knew that Queenie was going to be like quite irritating. Yeah. And that was fine. But I also wanted to surround her with women in the novel who are also, I don't want to say flawed, because it's not even flawed, just real and, you know, three-dimensional and have stuff. I think that's really important because we are all made up of that. And I think that, yeah, any opportunity for a woman to not have to be, because what is nice? Nice is basically, it's a front, I think. So I don't want to do that. I don't want to write that.
Tell me more about that, about nice being a front.
Because we're expected to be nice. I think we have to put the mask on. And I remember throughout so much of my publishing career, just having to put the mask on. And I found that so tough. I think that would just break all the time because I was always like, this isn't real and this isn't me. And like, I'm a nice person generally, you know, so to speak. I mean, some people would disagree. But like, I tried to be nice and I tried to be caring in that way. But I also don't believe that nice is a full person. And so I think that when we put that mask on, we end up having to strip away parts of ourselves. And being nice is usually that just translates into trying to make people comfortable.
There's so much I want to ask you about your writing and your second novel, People Person, which we'll come on to. But I also want to ask you about publishing, because you're in a fairly unique position in that you've seen it from inside and outside as someone who worked for publishers and then published a book yourself. It is a notoriously white middle class industry.
Yes.
And I mentioned in the introduction that critics said
two things really about Queenie amongst loads of the praise. They referred to Queenie as a Black Bridget Jones, but they also, different critics, made the point that it was a sort of quote-unquote political book. And I suppose my slightly inelegantly framed question is whether you can ever write anything that isn't political as a Black British woman working in this specific industry. It feels very much like the personal is political. Do you agree?
I do agree. I don't think you can. And there's a book called The Other Black Girl, which is American, and it's kind of a horror, but it's a Black girl who's working in the publishing industry. And the author has politicized it in the way that it has to be political because like horror is basically political. But like all of those things are coming to the forefront, and the fact that you can't escape who you are when you work in this industry, and that your existence is seen differently and you are perceived differently. And the ways that people engage with you are just based on, I guess, their understanding of who you are rather than the person that you are. And I remember when I started working in publishing, taking everyone for who they were, because of course I would do that, but just understanding so clearly that they were seeing me as someone different from the off. And so, yeah, I think that when your existence is political because of how you are framed, anything that you create is going to have to show that. But it is exhausting because, and even if you're not trying to say something, you end up saying something because the people who are receiving you are having to do kind of like double think to work you out.
And then ask you about it. And so then you have to explain it, and it's not your role to explain, it's your role to write a really great story, which you did.
Thank you. Yeah, basically, yeah.
But the other way in that I think it was refreshingly political is that Queenie opened with the protagonist being given a gynecological examination, which I bloody loved because you hardly ever read about that in fiction, let alone open a book with it. And it was so relatable. And I was sort of astonished that no one had thought of doing that before, or that I had never thought of doing it before, because it affects all women, really. Yeah. And it was just such a genius thing to do. Did you always intend on starting the book that way?
Yeah, so it wasn't even necessarily to shock. And a lot of people are like, oh yeah, you have this shocking opening that really brings us in. And that wasn't my intention. I knew that Queenie, as Black women often are, would be seen as this incredibly strong person, even though what she's going through is really, really tough. And she is showing her vulnerabilities on every page. But I wanted to start her off in the most vulnerable position that you can really find a woman, because I wanted people to empathize with her in that way, if that makes any sense. So I was like, I don't want you to be walking down the street feeling confident or feeling positive or in the middle of an argument. I want people to come at you as being fully exposed in every single way that a woman can be, just so that people would warm to her or understand her.
Yeah, and you're very funny as well. And I think you do a very good job in both Queenie and People Person, your hotly awaited second novel, of balancing humour with depth.
Thank you.
I just want to salute you for, because it's so hard to write a second novel, I imagine, after an astonishing success with your debut. Did you find it difficult?
It was crazy. So a couple of authors, including Kit Duvall, said, because we've got the same agent, and I met her at my agent's party, and she said, you know, I reckon you just like, you got to try and get the second one done before all the Queenie press starts, because that's going to be a lot. And I was like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. So I sat and I wrote this whole second novel, and I submitted it, and my agent and editor were like, yeah, this is great. This is really great. And when I was editing it in lockdown, I was like, I'm not vibing with this at all. Like, this feels like lockdown changed us all so much. And because I'd had so much time to forcibly sit with myself and think about the person that I was, think about how everything around Queenie had affected me, when it came to this novel that I'd written before I had been that person, I was like, no, this isn't me anymore. So I actually binned that. And when I saw my editor, I was like, hi, just so you know, I've started a new one. And she was like, right, all right, right. Okay, yeah, we can make it work. Right. I have been pissing her off up until today. But this version of People Person, this felt like the one I wanted to write about. And I love it so much. And it was painful at times. And at so many points, I was like, I am not going to be able to, how am I going to finish this? I just had no idea how I was going to do it, because I'm talking about stuff that is close to me but far from me because it's fiction, and also just being in a different space, and also like still doing Queenie stuff and being like, okay, so there's that one. Obviously, Queenie's done its own thing. But my agent, Jo Unwin, she said to me, I think that you're comparing all the big stuff that happened with Queenie, all of the things that you've done since then, all the interviews, all the things you've been invited to, you're comparing that to what you're writing now, which is just a draft. You sit in your pajamas and you write a draft. And so like, get that out of your head before you just like, do you know what I mean? Like the pressure of, she was basically like, this is not the same thing. The pressure of like, this is not the same as what Queenie did. So just like, get it out of your head. And that was the best advice, because I was like, yeah, you're right, let me just like get this story out and then like everything else we come to. And that was really helpful.
People Person has one of the most striking opening chapters I have ever read.
Thank you.
Honestly, that first chapter is so good. So I was like, how is she doing this? Because I don't want to give too much away, but basically it's a family of five siblings. There are five siblings.
There we go.
Everyone shares the same dad. So first of all, I just don't know how you handle that many characters. Do you have loads of post-it notes all over your study?
No, I just know them. It's really interesting. I basically start with like who they're going to be. Like I just have, I'm like, okay, what's their name? That's the first thing. So I do their names and then I have to do their star sign. And as soon as I've done their star sign, I just know who they are. And so I'm like, okay, let's go. Do you know what I mean? Like that's the easiest thing for me to do, because I'm really into the Zodiac. I don't know. I'm not like a witch, but I just spend a lot of time figuring people out as per who they are, because of their star sign, if that makes sense. So I'm like, I know how to like work with you because I know the kind of person that you are and what you're going to expect or what you're going to give. And so I also know who to avoid. So that's how I start. So then basically because of that, that's how I can like form their characters. Then they just argue in my head and it's actually very easy from there.
Okay. So Cyril Pennington is their dad. And the opening chapter sees him make this appearance in an unforgettable gold Jeep. And he's driving around London to go and collect his children. He is an extraordinary, unique character. And you don't shy away from the fact that he has, in many respects, been an absent father. And I wanted to know where that creation came from, because I felt like he was living and breathing off the page.
Yeah, he is just an amalgam of lots of the dads that I have known. So it's like a little bit of my dad, a little bit of like my friend's dads, a little bit of like other dads I've like met at family parties and been like, oh, I've got your number. He was just very easy to imagine because I have just known that man in different forms. And so, again, like character to me is never the problem. I don't even know what the problem is. The character stuff is never there. I think for me, it is just being able to like be present enough in myself to be able to sit down and write. Like that's always the thing, because my brain is always going in 100 directions and I am such an emotional person. I'm so tied to all my feelings that like if I am having like a bad day. So like the weather is absolutely terrible today. My SAD is like through the roof. And so like, I was just like, I can't really do anything. So I know I can't do any work today because like, I can't connect with myself. And so that's always a thing. But like Cyril, I just know Cyril. And right. I don't dislike Cyril. I really like Cyril because Cyril's just doing what Cyril can do. You know, that's all he can do.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's the key to any kind of empathy, let alone authorial empathy, is understanding that people generally are doing the best they can do as the people they are. Yeah. And I think you show that really beautifully. But that, I think, will be so reassuring for a lot of listeners to hear, that you start by connecting with yourself.
Yeah.
And if it's not going to happen, you're kind enough to yourself to say, it's not going to happen, so I'm not going to write today. Can I ask you how long it took you to get to that acceptance of yourself?
It's still something that I'm like trying to figure out, but I think probably like properly in lockdown, because as I said, lockdown was a time for being like, because I live by myself. So I was like, who are you now that you're staying still? What's going on? Let's talk. And that was really, really hard because I had to like sit and figure out the stuff that I had been running from, or the stuff that I was trying to avoid, and the stuff that I was feeling. And like moving was great because it just meant that I could just like run away from it all. Lockdown was me being like, all right, you know, the world is in chaos and everything is really scary and everything is, you know, you're just grieving all the time. Everyone's grieving collectively. But like, what's going on in your head? And just figuring out like how I work. And actually just, in such a big way, figuring out who I am, and also work being a part of that and work not being my life, and just figuring out then. So yeah, some days, of course, work is not your life. So obviously some days work is not going to happen because you don't feel connected to it. And that was it, you know? So I'm going to say lockdown was that time for me.
And on a day when you do feel connected to yourself, I understand that you will normally settle down to do work about 4 or 5 p.m.
Yeah.
You're a night owl.
Even then, like a lot of the time, it's like maybe when it's dark, basically, when it's dark, because in the day I'm always like, what? Hello? What's going on? And then when it's nighttime, I'm like, let's go. So yeah, it's usually nighttime.
And do you not need sleep? Like, how much do you sleep? Now I'm just worried about you.
No, I'm all right. No, it's all right, Elizabeth. I'm cool. Don't worry. I don't sleep enough, definitely. And that's okay. Like, I can just run on, like, not a lot of sleep. But it's better for me just because, like, my phone isn't going off and I'm not, like, worrying about if everyone is okay. I spend a lot of my time being, like, if my phone rings, it's because something happened to someone. And so that's why I can write stuff that is, you know, like, chaotic, because, like, that's my brain. But I usually, like, a good burst of writing, which happens a lot, is usually just, like, I sit down, the opening of People Person, that was about 10,000 words. And that was just one night. That was just me just being like, wow. Right, I'm changing it. I'm starting a novel. Let's just go. And then 10,000 words later, and I think it was like 5 a.m., I was like, yeah, that feels good.
Dimple, one of the characters in People Person, like you, is a Cancer. I think I'm right.
Absolutely.
In that.
Yes.
And unlike you, is a wannabe social media influencer. But you gave this quote once, which just made me laugh. And I'd love to read it out now, which is, everyone asks me, are you Queenie? And it's so reductive and so frustrating. You don't ask Ian McEwan if he was a soldier or if he had a premature ejaculation issue.
Yeah. Ever. It's really annoying. I was trying to find an article that I'd written for something. So I had to Google like Candice Carty-Williams and then like the name of the article, the person I interviewed. And it was like frequently asked questions. And the first one was, is Candice Carty-Williams Queenie? And I was like, people are Googling this stuff. Like, seriously, wow. I can't, it's mad. And so, yeah, I find that really hard. I find that such a strange thing that people would not just expect people to have an imagination. Like, it's like, that's my job now. I get paid now to have an imagination. So that's what I'm doing. I mean, it happens to women a lot more, obviously, but also, you know, there are so many problems around that. And I would never, ever read Queenie because I just didn't want to invite the comparison. So like every event that I did, they'd always say that, like, oh, can you start with a reading? And I would say no, because I was like, people are just going to just take that away and assume that she is me. And I found that so hard. And so I also held that in my mind when I was writing this, and I was like, yeah, we can have the same qualities, me and Dimple. She is very different to me. She's a very different Cancer to me because everyone has their different stuff. It's usually trauma-based. I just was like, I need to write a character who no one can compare me to. And that is,
yeah,
that's what I did.
When I wrote my first novel, there was a sort of semi-photographic cover of a young girl with an oversized doll's house on her shoulder. And I got asked whether that girl was me. I got, like, literally, is that a childhood photo? Because it came up so often, whether it was autobiographical. And I think you're right that it happens to women a lot more, as if we're not capable of looking beyond our own navel. But also, I think it's because maybe people find the notion of a woman who can imagine so effectively to be somewhat scary, which is a whole other thing.
I think so. I agree with that. But also, like, you know, there is that really stupid societal idea that, like, women feel things and men don't feel anything. And so it's like, I think it's assumed that, like, writing a novel is just like another one of our outlets for us to talk about what we've been going through. Whereas, like, men don't have to do that. And I find that really fucking annoying.
Yeah. Well, talking about outlets to talk about what you've been going through, your first failure is not going to therapy sooner. So Candice, tell us about that and the journey that led you to therapy.
I remember when I was really young, so I was at school and I was 11, 12, obviously, I start school at 11. And very early on, my teachers said that I had behavioural issues, which I found really irritating because I just asked a lot of questions, and I knew even as an 11-year-old, I wasn't like badly behaved. I was just like, what does that mean? That doesn't make sense. I don't really get that. It was suggested as part of that to my mum that I had therapy, and I went to a therapist that was in Sydenham, I remember, after school. at like 4 o'clock, and it was like every week. And eventually I just stopped going because I was like, this is weird. I felt like I was just getting told off all the time, and that didn't really make any sense to me because I was like, I just don't think I'm doing anything wrong. So I didn't go back to therapy for ages because I was just like, I linked it in my head with something that was just like, you're just going to get told off about stuff. So I just carried on living life. And then when I was in my early 20s, I've said many times before that one of my best friends, he had cancer. And that was really hard because it was like I'd left university. I didn't really know what I was going to do. I thought I was in control of my own life in some way. And then when I realized like, that this could happen, my idea of what control was just spun out. And I was super, super anxious. I was so anxious all the time. It was horrible. It was like a really dark time in my life that I don't actually really think about because I think it's a bit too painful to think about, but I can talk about it today. But I was really ill for like 2-3 years, couldn't leave the house, couldn't really eat, lost so much weight. I looked like a different person and I really didn't like it because to me that was just like, you're just not well, you're not yourself, you can't cope. And I've always been like relatively sociable, like to an extent. I'm not an extrovert at all, but I like being around people basically. Like I'm not going to be in the middle of the room, but I like being around people. And I couldn't do anything. I couldn't go anywhere. I couldn't see my friends. It was really, really bad. And eventually I had CBT. I remember I eventually went to the doctor and I was like, yeah, I'm really, something's really not okay. Like I just, my head is not right. And they put me on the waiting list for CBT and they said, yeah, that's going to be a year. And I, after like 2 weeks, I called them up and I was like, if it's in a year, I won't be here because I can't do this. And they were like, okay, we understand now. A couple of weeks later, I started seeing a therapist as part of CBT. And actually one of my friends used to have to sometimes get the bus with me if I couldn't do it myself. It was bad. It was a bad time. And at the end, my CBT therapist was like, it was like 12 sessions over 12 weeks. And she was like, you know, you've done well, but there is a core issue here that you aren't thinking about. You know, all this comes from something. And I was like, ah. I found a therapist via Anxiety UK because the NHS waiting lists were very long. It was like means tested. And these times I didn't even work in publishing. I didn't have a job. I was like freelancing here and there. And so I couldn't really afford therapy like that. So I found a means tested therapist and that was like £40 a session, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. The thing with that was it was really great to do, but it was like when you go to therapy, when you're in crisis, you're really just there to like not be in crisis. And so I then stopped doing it when I wasn't so anxious anymore. I can generally cope with stuff. It was a huge thing for me. And then I just didn't do it after that. I just stopped. I was like, all right, I'm okay. I can leave the house now. And then slowly I started to like rebuild my life and like did internships, like published internships, got a job, like had a boyfriend. And then I was like, okay, cool. Like this is okay. And I was like kind of just like coping with everything all the time, but I was able to do that stuff. So I was like, you're better in a way because you can leave the house. You can go to work. You can have a relationship. And then after everything that happened with Queenie and when lockdown hit, I was like, there's still something going on, but I'm not in crisis. So I obviously don't need to go to a therapist. Like I can leave the house. So I'm all right. When I found out that I won the British Book Award for best, what was it? Book of the Year. When it was going to be announced, a lot of people would be like, well done, well done, well done. And I was like, I absolutely hate myself. And wow. Everyone saying that I'm amazing or like, well done, you're the best, like this is what you've done, is going to be so at odds with how I feel that it's going to really fuck me up. And so like the day before it was going to be announced, I found a therapist and I was like, yeah, there's some stuff I need to talk about. And I've been with her ever since and it has changed my life completely. I'm one of those people that's like everything happens for a reason. But I'm also kind of sad because I'm like, what life could you have lived if you'd done this before? But I'm also like, but you just had to get here. So it's fine.
Candice. First of all, I want to say thank you for talking with such openness and honesty about that, because I think it's so important that people hear it. Secondly, I think it's so crucial. It goes to the foundational premise of this podcast that what looks like success outside doesn't always feel like that inside. And I just think you're a really amazing person for people to look to as an example of that level of bravery. Can I take you back to where it all began? So when you were a teenager being told that you had behavioral problems, what was going on for you at the time?
I was living with my mum and her partner, and I'm never going to go into it that much. I'm never going to ever talk about what was going on in that house just because there's family who would not, I don't want to do that. But effectively, it was not a very good time. And it was a really big struggle. And also just like hormonal changes. And also just like I had left the family that I had lived with in South West London to come to South East London. And basically, I was very lonely. I was very lonely. And I was also in an environment that was not good for me. And so I just spent a lot of my teen life just being by myself and also like wanting to be by myself because that felt safer than being with people. And it was hard because I'd come from an environment that was always quite busy and quite nurturing. I had a lot of family around me when I was growing up. And then suddenly I was in this house and it wasn't like that. And that was really, really, really tough. No, it's all right. I'm all right. I'm making peace with it. But that loneliness, I can't describe it and I can never go, you know, it's like, I can't describe it because it's a feeling rather than anything else. But yeah. I remember being lonely and I think I just wanted to talk when I was at school. I wanted to talk. I wanted to ask questions because I didn't have a voice at home. I basically was at school and I was like, I don't want to be lonely. I don't want to be quiet.
Oh, I'm so sorry. And I know you're saying you're fine, but I just, my heart goes out to young Candice there. In your family setup, such as it was, could you talk about mental health or was it something that wasn't spoken about that much?
Oh God, not at all. No, not at all. It wasn't a thing. And also like, it's really funny. It was not actually, it's actually not funny at all. That's why I need to stop doing that. When I was growing up, my nan, she nicknamed me Mother because she was like, you know, she's very wise. You know, she's very young, but she's been here before. And so she'd always call me Mother because it was like this little girl who was always like asking questions and was like quite authoritative and was quite wise and would listen to things. And so from a very early age, it was just understood by me and by everyone else that I could just absorb and take things that adults should. And so that was a big problem because I ended up being like, I'm fine, I should just be strong and everything is about and around that. And my family didn't really help that. And I remember if I'd ever said I was like sad, it was just like, go and have a cup of tea. Or go and say your prayers or don't think about that. The hard thing about my family was like, it was like, I'm sad too, but you don't see me talking about it. And it was like, sick, okay, cool. I won't talk about it either. And so I understood just like by absorption of that being kind of the thing that I should just keep it to myself because everyone else should. And I should grow up and I should be like these women who keep all this stuff to themselves, but I hear little things or I catch little passive aggressive arguments. You know, they might say something one day and then be like, but anyway, never mind me. I'm just, you know, and that was really hard because there was obviously, I didn't even understand the concept of like therapy. I didn't understand talking about your problems, let alone talking to someone who was a professional who could help you deal with them.
At the beginning of this interview, you talked about how the character of Cyril Pennington in People Person is an amalgam of various people, but partly based on your own dad. Was writing him in any way therapeutic for you?
Not really. Like, I've made, like my dad is just my dad. I made peace a long time ago with the guy that my dad is. And, you know, he just is who he is. And that's kind of it. I don't really chat to him. And so I know that a lot of my issues around everything come from the people that I grew up with rather than my, I didn't grow up with my dad. So it's kind of like, I always kind of knew the role he had in my life was to be there sometimes. And I grew to understand that. So when I was young or even now, I don't expect him to ever be like a father figure because he just isn't that person. And he was never that person. I never understood him to be that person. And so he couldn't really let me down in that way. And so I guess it was hard to explore in People Person what a dad could be for people and what these characters assumed that their dad would have been for them. Because I know that for me, I've never expected my dad to be anyone but who he is. But I'm dealing here with five of his kids, Cyril Pennington's kids, who were like, I always wanted differently from him. And that was really hard because I felt sad for them because I was like, I can see where that hope comes from.
Yeah. So when I said in the introduction about how books were your refuge when you ended up in Lewisham Library as a teenager, is that true? Do you feel like they made you feel less lonely?
Yeah, for sure. For sure, for sure, for sure. When I was young, I would just lock myself in my room and I would read. And then when I was told to go to bed, I would pretend I had a stomachache and sit in the bath and read. because I was like, oh, no, 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 I'm just really ill. I've got to stay in the bathroom. That was just the way that I got out of my head. And my head is so busy all the time that I just need to be somewhere else, because otherwise my brain just goes into a million different places that I shouldn't go to. But books had always been that thing for me. And that is why I spent so much time in libraries and I spent so much time around them. I don't know. They just feel like a safe space. Needing to be outside of yourself and understanding that there is a world that is different to the one that you're in now was the thing for me too. And not necessarily by being like, oh, you could be an author, but just more like all these books represent all of these different versions of life. That was really important to me because I just didn't like the life that I had.
So when you started getting those internships and publishing that turned into a full-time job, was it depressing that you were confronted with the fact that your reality growing up wasn't as reflected in fiction as it could have been?
Obviously, there is sadness around it, but I'm not really like a dweller because I live in my feelings so much that I'm like, well, we have to do something with it. And so
right.
I saw it and I was like, okay, what's next? Like, what do we do? So I wasn't like, oh God, like this is the reality. I was like, okay, cool. What do we do? Because I just clocked very quickly and I immediately was like, hey, how do we fix this? And I went to like the bosses and I was like, yeah, how do we fix this? Or like, what can I do? Because that's just how my brain works. I'm just like, I'm sad, but I'm a doer, you know?
And you created the Guardian and Fourth Estate BAME Short Story Prize, which is, yes, I think, one of the first of its kind and such a brilliant prize. And you did that.
Yeah, no, it was the first of its kind. Like literally no one had thought to do anything like it. But that's just reflective of the industry and no one being there to be like, oh, I see there's an issue here. So how do I fix it? And so I just had the idea. I took a week off work. I think I was also breaking up with my ex-boyfriend at the time. But I remember just being like, this is a good focus as well, because I was just like, took a week off. And then it was like, how would we do this? And then I was sending my colleagues, Tom and Lettuce at the time, all of these ideas and being like, how can we do that? Could you help me with that? Maybe do you think that would work? Because I was just like, yeah, I just wanted to do something because I was like, yeah, things just can't stay like this.
Do you think, returning to the theme of your failure, that going to therapy has made you a better writer or has in any way affected your writing?
Do you know what? I was terrified that going to therapy would mean that I couldn't write anymore, because I find like really bad stuff funny. When horrible stuff happens to me, I just laugh because I'm like, oh God. And that's why I tried to write humor, because my nan always said, if you don't laugh, you'll cry. So I've had it in me to be like, well, like crying isn't really going to change anything. Like it's good to cry, but it's also just like, you have to do something or you just have to laugh about it. And so yeah, I was really scared. I remember meeting my editor after I'd sent her the first new 10,000 words of People Person. And I was like, can you tell me if it's shit? Because I'm not as traumatized anymore. And she was like, that's really bad way of thinking about things. And I was like, all right, okay, cool. Because I know who I am more, I can definitely write with more purpose in that way. And just like really connect with what's going on. Like Queenie was like, I was 25. And so like the confidence you have at 25 and also just being like, I'm going to use my voice. Like that was how I was when I was that age. And now I think it was also age too. Like it's like I'm more considered and I think more about every single thing that I'm saying. Whereas I see passages of Queenie and I'm like, oh my God. Because obviously I'm adapting it. I've never read Queenie back since I wrote it, of course. And so like if I have to go back to the book to like look at something for a reference, I'm always like, just get through as quickly as possible. Because some of the sex scenes are absolutely wild. And I would just never write that again. I would never write that at this age. But it's also just like, I can take time now, which is good. And I remember back then, everything was like very immediate and everything was like, get it on the page. But now I'm like, no, no, no. Just sit with yourself. And also just, as I said, the understanding of being like, if you can't write today, you can't write today. And just like therapy also helped me understand that like, I'm not a machine. And one thing that my therapist actually really helped me understand, which I hadn't really put two and two together on, was that when I'm writing a nice scene, I feel good. And when I'm writing a sad scene, I feel absolutely terrible because I'm sad because I'm living with all those characters and what they're feeling. And she was like, did you never make the distinction that like, when you write that, you're in that? And I was like, oh my God. And so it's just also making sure that when I write, I take care of myself. When I'm writing those scenes that are hard or particularly painful, I've got to be like, this is having an effect on you as a writer. You're not just like at your desk being like, okay, cool, so what's going to happen next? You're like, fuck, this is fucking horrible. And I'm feeling it with all of them.
It's like you're being mother again, isn't it? And absorbing the emotion of your fictional family.
Yeah.
Before we move on to your second failure, I just want to thank you again for talking about that. And also to mention your friend, I believe he was called Dan.
Yes.
Who you said had cancer and who sadly died. And I just wanted to mention his name and to thank you for talking about it, because I can only imagine how painful it is.
Thanks. I'm still in touch with his parents, which is nice. And it's really nice to hold on to that. And, you know, I always ask them if it's okay for me to talk about him or to, and they're always really happy for me to do that because they know how important he was to me. Still is to me. But yeah, no, you're welcome. It's part of life, but, you know, it's hard.
It is. Your second failure is not having boundaries with people sooner. And I was so happy when I saw this because I can't tell you how much I relate. Just tell us about boundaries and how to do them.
Do you know what? I actually got, hold on, my co-star today, the alert was remember your boundaries. And I was like, oh. I'm trying. Yeah, but I find boundaries very hard because my existence feels like it's like, how do you look after everyone? How do you care about everyone? Put yourself second. And that is really, really tough because I just very naturally put myself second. And any situation that I'm in, I'm always like, is this person happy? Are they comfortable? I also pick up on people's emotions. And this whole like empath thing is like, it can be really real. I can sit with someone and be like, something's happened. You can talk about it now, you can talk about it later. But like, we need to sit and figure this out. And even when someone messages me, I'm like, so what's going on, you know? I think when you have that, it just means that you just end up giving all of yourself to other people and then having nothing back or just not having anything for yourself. And so boundaries are, I'm still getting there, but just like understanding what a boundary is. And also that like, you have to put them in place because they're helpful to both of you. To you and the other person is very real.
Yeah. Well, my best friend who's a therapist always explains it in this way, which is that if you have a boundary in place, it's actually a really loving act because when you feel able to say no, it means that your yes carries extra weight and meaning. Because when you say yes, you can fully lean into that commitment. And the person knows that because you've set that boundary in the first place. But it still is really hard to do in practice, even knowing that. So what are some boundaries, Candice, that you've been able to put in place for yourself over the last few years? Because I imagine the demands on your time have gone absolutely crazy.
Yeah. The first thing I did, which was very helpful, which I learned from Nikesh Shukla, who's a friend of mine, another author. He had this amazing out of office that is like, if you don't need to talk to me, here are the things that you can take from this email. So it's like, if you need to talk about this, email this person. And so I was like, can I use that? And I've got this out of office that is like, if this is not urgent, then here are all the other people that you can talk to about this. And that has helped me so much because it means like, if I'm in writing mode, which I always am, I can't always just like reply to like, hi, here is my headshot. Talk to this person. No, yeah. I can't do that. It's like, because I hate ignoring people. And that's the hardest thing. I think for me, the hardest boundary that I have to get across is like, if you don't reply to someone immediately and with care, they're going to think that you hate them. And that is one of my biggest things. And so I'm always trying to get to people as quickly as possible to be like, yeah, okay, here you go. Yeah, you can have that. Yeah, I've seen this. Yeah, that's really funny. Ahaha, thanks for that. Like, yeah, no, I have heard that. And so that most of my life is just being like, yeah, no, yeah, I've seen it. Yeah, are you okay? Yeah, you're not okay? Do you want me to come around? And so the out of office was the first step of being like, you can have everything you need, but I don't have to give it to you. And that was like the best thing. And then
that's
like,
so good.
It's just really helpful because I'm like, if this urgent request comes through, it's like, you know who to talk to because I'm not there. Okay. I'm not there. And so like when it comes to friends, it's a very different thing because I literally am obsessed with all my friends. I love them so much. So it's like, I do really want to give you everything, give you the world, but also just being like, but you don't have to do that right now. You can just like take a minute. And that's important to me because like, I talk to so many people in the day. I just have so many people that I want to chat to or like send stuff to. But actually, I just have to now it's about me being like, just breathe first, because like, you can't do what you need to do because like, you're trying to juggle all of these things, look after all of these people. And that has been an amazing thing. That is great, because I struggled so much when Queenie was out, because I just couldn't talk to anyone because my brain just wasn't there. I felt like I was going all the time. I was thinking about something different all the time. I was on a train, I was with my publicist, I was signing books, and that was amazing. The whole thing I loved. It was very hard and very taxing for someone who is not an introvert, but also is an extrovert. But it just meant that I just had to abandon anyone that was talking to me in my phone, because I was like, I can't give you what you need. And so now I found a balance of being like, what is the boundary of what you can give people? And also just like, you know, if people are messaging me being like, I'm having such a bad day, being like, I'm also having a bad day. I'll come back to you when I'm not having a bad day. And that's been really important.
Yeah, I think that's so important to hear. What did you discover when you had that time of not answering the people in your phone? Did you discover that actually your real friends were completely understanding of it? Because I've been through patches like that, and it's been so reassuring to realise that the people who matter get it, and the people who don't get it don't matter.
Yeah, I've managed to maintain most of my friendships, which is really important to me as well, because I have such a thing about keeping people that I care about very close all the time. But also that's just because like my best friend died, right? So like, I'm always going to be like, loss feels like grief every single time. So I'm always like, just keep everyone who is your best friend or who is your friend near you, because the idea of losing a friend just has a similar effect to when I lost my friend. And I also lost another friend after that. So I'm always kind of like straddling that grief space. I had a lot of good friends who stayed because they understood. I have a lot of friends who understood, and I'm very lucky in that I do attract very good people. So all of my, I guess you get what you give out, right? So like,
yeah,
all the people who are close to me are just good people, and they just get it, and they wouldn't be close to me if they didn't. I have lost some friends. The most of the friends that I have lost are straight men, because they don't really understand. I had one friend that I had to, after trying to put a boundary in place for a long time, be like, please stop saying this thing that you're saying to me, because I find it hurtful and painful. It wasn't directed at me, but he just stopped speaking to me because he was like, that boundary, I don't like it. And if I can't offload on you all the time, then I don't want to be your friend. And I was like, well, that's fine.
Wow. And what about boundaries in romantic relationships? Have you historically struggled with them?
Historically, I don't really have romantic relationships because I just don't like them. I don't really, how do I, I'm trying to,
I love that answer so much.
I'm just not really, it's really tough. And I've been working with my therapist for a long time. Like, I'm like, oh, like, what is it? And she was like, Candice, we've been working together for 2 years. She's like, I just think you don't want to be in a relationship. And I was like, I feel like that as well. I'm just not really into them in that way. I figured it out. I'm really into connection, but I'm just not really into labels, because I think labels just change stuff. So if I have a connection with you, that is amazing and that is great, but I don't think we need to. Like, I've never said to someone, what are we? I will never, ever ask that question of anyone, because I'm not interested in having that conversation ever. Maybe that will change if I meet someone who is incredible. I'm like, oh, actually, but actually, as it stands, I'm like, no. So I don't have to have boundaries in romantic relationships because they don't exist, because I am not keen.
So that's so interesting, because it makes such sense of the plot of People Person, in the relationships that you're examining in that book don't have an easy label, but they are all really important relationships in their own way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that all relationships are really important, and they are like effectively relationships in the sense that they are. But when you have to think about what society would call it, and that sounds really annoying, but you know what I mean? Because so much of it is like, it's basically, that is what society is telling you the thing has to be. And it's like, but if that doesn't fit, it doesn't fit. And there is this idea of like a half sibling or a step sibling, or, but if you're my sibling, you're just my sibling. I have so many half siblings. I have like a lot of step siblings. And if I refer to them, I would never refer to them as my half or my step anything. That's my sibling. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, the same way that like, my friend's friend's children are my nieces. Like, that's just how it works. Like, I just think, like, you just find what you fall into. But the idea of having to give it a strict term, who is policing that? You know? Yeah. So I'm just like, I'm not really into it.
What does your mum think of your career?
What does my mum think of my career? She's proud in her way. She's proud. She hasn't read Queenie. She hasn't read Empress and I. She won't read People Person. She knows what I do. She tells everyone what I do, but she doesn't really engage in what I do. But she'll be like, oh, are you working? Make sure you look after yourself. Do you need anything? But I think it's good for me that she and the rest of them, just kind of the rest of my family that I have relationships with or that I chat to, that they are just like, that's her job. Like, as I've said before, I love what I do. It's so important to me and I really live for it and I really put everything into it and I care about it so much, but it's also a part of my life. It can't be my whole life. Like, if I go to my nan's house, she's like, yes, can you bring milk and potatoes again? Can you pick up the Hoover when you get here? She's not interested in being like, oh, and so I saw you in the newspaper. She doesn't care. Do you know what I mean? And that's important to me because it's like, my mum and everyone else are just like, yeah, that's what Can does. And that's nice.
I also think there's a liberation with that as well, that you're completely free to write what you need to write without worrying how it might be received. So I completely get why that's offers a kind of creative space.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And also it kind of helps know that they're not going to read it because it's like, I can say what I want. And exactly. I would never talk about them. I would never write about anyone in my family or anything that, you know, because that would be a thing. But also it just means that, like, just when you think, talk about things that, like, sex. But my nan actually is quite into, like, talking about sex and stuff. So it's like, she's not the problem. But my mum is a bit, like, coy about it. So it's like, okay, I can, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Boundaries. Boundaries.
Boundaries.
Your third failure, there's a kind of change in tone here, which is not getting to see the full Amy Winehouse set at a music festival in 2007. Absolutely. Tell us the story.
I went to Benicassim, which was in Spain, with some people from school, and we were young. We were like 17, 18, and I knew that Amy Winehouse was going to be there. I just knew because I loved and love Amy Winehouse so much. She's still so important to me. I remember being like, we have to go and see that. But just the people I with, you know, when people are like away from home and they're like, we can just drink everything. We can just like take loads of drugs. I never took drugs. I've never taken drugs. I just like to say, because if my nan does hear this, just want her to know. But like everyone was doing that. And also like, I was always quite sensible. I've always been like, okay, but what are we going to do? Where are we going to go? Like, let's line this up. Like, I'm not necessarily, when it comes to like things I want to see and do, I'm not like, let's just, yeah, okay, call them up for that. I'm falling into it. I'm like, here's the plan. And whenever I go on holiday with any of my friends, I'm always like, these are the things that I would like us to do. And I don't care when we get there, but this is what we're doing. And so like with Benicassim, I was like, yes, I'm going to see Amy Winehouse. That's amazing. And then there was like a rumor that she actually wasn't performing. So we were like, oh, okay, fine. And then like we just went and like did nothing and just like walked around. And then someone was like, wait, who is that playing? And someone was like, oh, it's Amy Winehouse. And I have never moved so fast in my life. A group of us ended up like at the corner, like in the back, like trying to like hear the rest of it. And I managed to like see her on stage and catch like a bit of her performance. But I will always be sad that like I listened to the rumor that she wasn't actually performing. That really cut me because like, when she was around, I just didn't go to her gigs because I just thought I always would, because I just thought she'd always be there. And then I realized I was so young. When she passed away, she was 27. And when I was younger, I was like in my early 20s when she passed away. And I remember being like, wow. And now I'm 32. I'm like, 27 is so young. And just realizing that like my young head was like, oh, I have years to see her. I have years to see her perform. And so like when I look back on it now, I'm like, that is the person that I wish I'd got to see properly, because she was just Amy.
I think there's such a profound lesson there about doing things right then and there, especially when it's someone who is such a creative, soulful inspiration. Yeah. Why do you think you connected with Amy's music so much? Or maybe it wasn't just her music, maybe it was her as well.
I love her music. I listen to music all the time, but I think her as a person, if you watch any of her interviews, she's just like, yeah, I'm just here. She was around at the time, like Adele was around, Lily Allen was around. And I remember there was like an award ceremony when they were like, oh, you're going to win big. And she was like, nah, Lily's just going to win it all. I just think more than anything, she understood so completely the space that she was in. And I think that always means a lot to me when someone is like, I'm just aware of like the machine and how it works. And even Kate Nash, like at the time, all of these artists who were kind of like forced to sit in these roles that their labels had told them they should sit in, But she just had no interest in that at all. And that was really, really, really important to me. So as a person, I was always like, she just says what she needs to say. That whole thing of being like, oh, she's so real. But I actually do think she was one of the realest artists that we will ever see. And actually, we did see. And it's really sad how, obviously, it's disgusting how the press treated her, because she didn't pretend that she was someone else. She didn't pretend that she wasn't struggling. She didn't pretend that she wasn't suffering with addiction issues. She didn't pretend that she wasn't having a horrible or a painful relationship. And obviously, that was her downfall. But I will always remember something that she said that I've always tried to take on. When someone interviewed her and they were like, you know, what are your aspirations? Like, what do you want to do with this album? Or like, how do you feel about everything? And they were comparing her to other artists. And she was like, yeah, look, I'm just determined on the next level. Like, I just want to do what I'm going to do. Like, and I have taken that. And I've always just had that in my head. And I'm not really good at remembering quotes of people, but I will always remember that that's what she said, because I think determination is always the thing, especially when you just don't fit into the mold that everyone else is trying to make you fit into. It's determination. It's like, I'm going to do it anyway. And that is why I will always love her. Yeah, for music. And I watch the Amy documentary so often, maybe like every few months, just because I love watching her write music and I love watching her poetry turn into lyrics. And I love how she feels the music. There's a bit of her recording with Mark Ronson and she's singing, I think it's Back to Black. And there's like a fade out and she stops singing. She's like, God, that was quite sad, wasn't it? I think she used to feel so deeply what she was singing, and her lyrics showed us that. And she was fun and she was playful and she was silly. And also she could have quite a harsh tongue, but also she really cared about what she was saying.
I love that documentary too, the Asif Kapadia one. Oh, and I remember, it's so good. I remember going to see it in the cinema and it was one of the first, I think probably the first feature length documentary I'd seen, which didn't have a narrator.
Yeah.
He manages to make this really creative collage and it's become now almost standard. But it was the first time I'd seen that and I thought that was such a beautiful act for a woman who had had her voice appropriated by so many people or ignored. It was just such a beautiful act of salvation, really.
Yeah, no, completely. I remember the first time I saw it, I went to Clapham, is it a picture house? Clapham Picture House near Clapham Common Station. And I went by myself because I do a lot of stuff by myself because, as you know, I don't want to be in a relationship. So I just like to, roam
also
free.
I love going to cinema by myself. It's the best thing. Oh, it's so God, underrated.
You don't have to talk to anyone about afterwards. You just sit with yourself. But I just had to sit there while the credits rolled just for like 20 minutes, just weeping and just try to like compose myself before I left, because I honestly couldn't. I just was like, you can't walk in a straight line while you're crying this much, because I thought, as you said, someone whose voice was taken over from her, but also just seeing, I just think so much of it is just like it could have been avoided. Yeah. And just knowing the loss, and also just having seen it when I was older and just being like, 27 was nothing, you know? 27 is, you haven't lived. That documentary is, yeah, one of the best I've ever seen.
So there's going to be a step change here, because I'm going to ask you a question and there's just no link to it. Well, I suppose there is a link, because the TV drama that you are writing for BBC, I believe, is set in the music industry. Am I right?
Yes.
Can you? Okay. Yes, you can. You tell us anything about it?
I can. I'm allowed to talk about it now, which is great. It's called Champion. It's BBC, but also Netflix globally, which is amazing, which I'm allowed
Flex,
to say.
That's incredible.
It's really good, isn't it? It's very good. I remember when we had to like pitch it to them and I was like sat and just being like, this isn't going to happen. I was driving and got a call from one of the like head producers and he was like, right, they're on board. And I was like, I'm going to crash the car, because it's just huge. But it's about effectively a musical family in some way. They're the Champion family. They live in South London, obviously. And it's Bosco Champion, who is this rap star, and he has been in prison for 2 years. And we find out why as the series goes on. And his long-suffering younger sister, Vita, has basically been his PA before he went in and has been managing everything for him afterwards. And their dad, Beres, used to be a sound man in Jamaica, and he came over and he was like, I'm going to make a name for myself, a name for this family. And their mum, Aria, she was an aspiring musician and she had to give up her career when she got pregnant with Bosco back in the day. And it's about those family ties and also what happens when, I guess, the son becomes a golden boy and everyone else is effectively overlooked. And the journey is Bosco versus Vita, when Vita steps into herself and she's like, actually, I have a voice too. Bosco.
Wow.
So it is really fun to write. And also we're creating original music for it. We're in the process now of like actually slotting everything into place and like talking to all of these. And also I've been able to speak to all of these amazing songwriters and producers and artists that are absolutely legendary. The casting is incredible. I can't say who it is. I can't say who's doing anything, but it's just like, I'm just every day, I'm like, I can't believe that I get to do this. It's absolutely mad. I was thinking today like about like how it ends and just being like, that's going to be fucking huge. Like, I just, I don't know. So I'm like, I'm so like shocked by it all still, like even though I'm writing it and working on it all the time, but it's just an amazing thing. And like, it's very different working in TV because in TV, you just have like a team around you all the time. And also being a showrunner means you just kind of figuring out everything for everyone. And just, I wake up to like 20 emails and messages being like, can you approve that? What do you think of that? Can you come back to that? You haven't replied to that. Can you just have a look at this grid? And I'm like, I am not this person. Ask me a question, I'll say yes or no. But then I say that, but then also I have a very strong opinion. So
So are you running a writer's room as a showrunner as well?
Yes. So we ran a writer's room and that was in lockdown and it was on Zoom. Wow. It was 4 weeks and it was 12 till 6 every day. And it was me and four other writers and me being like, okay, so what do you think? And trying to like scan everyone's face and be like, you don't look happy about that. What does that mean? What does that face mean? And that was really, really fun. It was amazing. And we get to the next one in person, which is great if we do that. The Zoom writer's room is a very unique thing and I don't wish to do it again. But
no, yeah. That's super draining. My goodness, it sounds so good.
Thank you.
I can't
it's
wait.
Just going to be like, there's just loads of stuff that's happening. And it's like, wow, okay. I think the thing was when we first started it, I remember being told by the production company, this just has to be as big as possible. Just like think big. And I was like, oh, I can think big. So that was fine. I can spend money. I can spend production money. Yeah. Don't worry.
And so that will be on our screens later this year.
I think early next year, because we start filming in June or July.
Okay, I can't wait to hear more about it. Champion. You are a champion, Candice Carty-Williams. I am in awe of everything you've achieved and everything that you are. And I'm so, so happy that you came on How to Fail. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode of How to Fail with Elizabeth Day, I would so appreciate it if you could rate, review, and subscribe. Apparently, it helps other people know that we exist.